RadioInfluence.com. The future is now.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Tuesday, November 12th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. I am Chris Landry, taking you through the entire world of college football, the NFL, taking a look at all things hither and yon, brought to you by our great folks at Radio Influence. We've got quite a few questions to get to today, Richard and Matt. I've got some particularly interesting questions we're going to get to. And a reminder that if you have a question for me, go to LandryFootball.com, hit contact Chris, and let me know that you're interested in getting this question answered and what have you. Send it to me. Tell me where you want me to answer it. I will do so. So today we're going to talk about a couple of things. One, we're going to revisit again a little bit as Chad Morris is out at Arkansas, a little bit of how I always look at it. People always want to know, okay, what's the difference between giving a guy another year in versus letting him go? We're going to get into that a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about the rankings tonight and how that might play out. And what does it really mean? Why are we doing it that way? And then again, we're going to get to answer your questions. But it was an interesting weekend of football. And I'm going to go in reverse order. Last night, what a great game, Seattle and San Francisco. And what I learned from that game is Russell Wilson is certainly clutch. Not mistake-proof. Not someone that can't make mistakes he did late, but boy, is he a winner. And he's a clutch guy and is always tough when you've got a guy like that that can put his offense on his back, create and make plays, extend plays. You know, the route's never dead. The play's never dead. And you see the difference. If you're looking at it, it looks like San Francisco's got the more complete team. They've got a really good pass rush. They can run the football. They're really dynamic. They're very, very good. And they were down a number of players and still played well, as was Seattle for that matter. But Jimmy Garoppolo's good, talented, but they've got to play well around him for them to win. And it makes you wonder, going into the playoffs, of which San Francisco is definitely going to be a part of, can they play around him enough, or can he elevate his game enough for them to go to distance? I think that's going to be the variable. The defense will play well. They'll be able to rush the passer. They'll be able to create field position. They'll be able to run the football. They'll be able to do all those things very well. But how effective can he perform under pressure? You saw it last night with the game in the balance. Garoppolo really struggled. It's not about just a bad throw here or there. He really was rattled in the pocket. Good Lord, he threw about 8 picks. I mean, they were dropped. Half of them were dropped, but there were mistakes. And so were there by Seattle. But you get the feeling that, you know, Russell's trying to make a play. He gets another opportunity. Look up. Chances are going to be there. And he's going to come up at the biggest moment. You just got the feeling. And I thought Kyle Shanahan did a wonderful job kind of creating a game plan and creating play calls around Jimmy Garoppolo to allow him to be successful. And I think that, you know, he gave him a chance, but man, was Garoppolo kept throwing the football to the wrong team and Seattle kept dropping it. That game would have been over. But thought it was interesting. It was an interesting week because San Francisco now has their first loss. So instead of a 3-game lead in the West, it's now a 1-game lead. And Seattle gets San Francisco week 17 in Seattle. So a lot of football left, but it basically takes a division that was going to be put away and keeps it alive for Seattle. Doesn't look like the Rams are going to get in that division race at any point in the year. But certainly San Francisco is ready to pull it away. It also keeps the race alive for the bye and home field advantage, as the Saints and Green Bay are the other two factors in that we shall see how it develops and plays out going forward. But Niners have a little tougher, the toughest schedule amongst San Francisco, Green Bay, and New Orleans. So we're going to see whether the quarterback gets exposed, whether the quarterback rises up to the moment. That's going to be pivotal, because I think this Niner team, particularly when healthy, really has got a lot of components that can make for a deep playoff run. Saints did not show up against Atlanta. Kansas City still struggling. Baltimore looks good. Green Bay took care of business. Can't say enough about Pittsburgh. Mike Tomlin handling adversity. How the team's playing, really, really impressive with what's going on there. Dallas losing, what, 4-6 now? They're starting to collapse again. Coaching issues, decision-making, a lot's going on there. It's going to be an interesting week. Houston, Baltimore play. New England, Philadelphia play. Chiefs and Chargers play in Mexico City. Saints have got Tampa Bay. Dallas goes to Detroit. So a lot of interesting matchups. On the college side, it was the story was in large part this past weekend, LSU, Alabama. And I get, I'm going to go big picture here. People will say, oh, it's a changing of the guard. Finally, Alabama is starting to lose its way. Alabama is no longer the dominant team that it has been. While I do not subscribe to that theory, I will say that Alabama looks different. And I've said it for over a year. I said it last year at this time, and it manifests itself in the national championship game. And it certainly is becoming a factor more and more, and it was against LSU. Alabama is no longer a dominant defense. They no longer control the line of scrimmage. That is what made Alabama great. They made plays in the passing game, but they were a run-dominant team that controlled, shortened the game, and the variables to winning and losing were not what it is now. You could make the case, okay, LSU was a better offense than Alabama. LSU performed better and executed better against Alabama's defense. LSU's defense is vulnerable. Alabama's defense is vulnerable. LSU didn't drop passes. The quarterback was, pardon me, 100% healthy and sharp. Alabama dropped passes and made mistakes. Alabama left plays on the field. LSU made some crucial mistakes, two on defense and one on special teams that aided Alabama's success. But in terms of Alabama, I think it's going to be interesting. They've gone the way of, we're going to open it up, RPO, so on and so forth. What does it really mean? My philosophy has been, still is, to win at the highest level of football in college, if you can recruit elite talent, on offense, you want to be able to run the football. Be tough, be physical, control the line of scrimmage. You have to have a quarterback who's a leader, who's tough, who is accurate, who can distribute the football. You need to have playmakers at receiver. If you can't move the football in an up-tempo fashion in a two-minute offense, you're going to be vulnerable. But if you can't run the football, you're also going to be vulnerable. That's what you have to have on offense, in my view. And I think you need to be a great defensive team. You need to be able to rush the passer. You need to be able to stop the run. You need to be able to match up. But you need to be able to pressure opponents. And I see some teams that are maybe not as complete. We see teams become more in the way of up-tempo, offense. Well, the offenses will have off-shooting nights at times. And when that happens, you fall by the wayside. So keep that in mind. Keep that in mind that as I look at Alabama, I see them going a little bit more like Oklahoma and less like what Alabama's been. And I think they're flawed. I don't think right now they look like a team capable of winning a national championship. They don't. Might they get in the playoffs? They might. They're going to need some help. But if they get there, I don't see them beating one of those teams. I think they'd fall short. I certainly wouldn't make them the favorite, and I would think it would be a decent little upset if they were to lose it. I do. It doesn't mean the end of the program. If anybody reinvents himself, it's Nick Saban. Tua's going to be gone. Those receivers are going to be gone. Do they go back more to line of scrimmage, run the football? Can they recruit to that? Can they develop that, still be able to throw it? Mac Jones, if he's the quarterback, is more of the A.J. McCarron type that could manage and throw the – is that good enough? Are they going to be good enough in the passing game doing that? Do they go back completely the other way again? I think all those things need to be examined. But the whole Alabama's dead, the new king has arrived, and it's LSU. Let's pump the brakes on that too. LSU is great because they have, and I think Ed Orgeron deserves all the credit, for merging a great young quarterback in Joe Burrow with a great talented offensive mind in Joe Brady in conjunction with Steve Ensminger with great receivers to have an offense that looks unstoppable. Yet, if they do have an off night, is their defense good enough? Remains to be seen. I think they're pretty good. But in terms of the future, who's LSU's quarterback going to be next year? I think the biggest reason for LSU's success, if you put the guy at number one for who's has LSU's success, it's Joe Burrow. People say, oh, no. Joe Burrow was there last year. He's different this year because of Joe Brady. He is. He's also different because he takes that system and he runs it. Joe Brady's system is not going to work as good without Joe Burrow. We'll see how effective he'll be, as I expect Joe Brady to return at LSU with a bumped up salary. I think we're going to see how good this offense can be and how much it is who's running it, who's the player, coach. I think those things are important. I don't think it's an overreaction to eliminate the process of, well, LSU's going to take over now. I think that's way jumping ahead. That Alabama doesn't look quite as good as fair. To say that LSU's getting ready to, take over, I think is way, way overstepping it at this point. But really impressed, and I do think LSU's the better team this year, and I do think if LSU and Alabama played again, I think LSU would win and probably win even more decisively. The other story was Minnesota's win over Penn State. Not shocking by any stretch, but they proved how good they are. They're a good line of scrimmage team. They can run the football. They've got as good a receiving core as there is in the Big Ten, a quarterback in Tanner Morgan that can really lead an offense and made some big-time throws. And a defense that plays well, they're well-coached. Penn State, not as well-coached. They're up and down. They're inconsistent. That's the reason why they are what they are. Can Minnesota run the table? I don't think they will, but it is a great story. Great test for them again against Iowa and then Wisconsin. And then if they handle that, then Ohio State. The rankings are coming out tonight. Much consternation is going to be on board about who's ranked four. I think it's the safest bet. The position that to me is the most obvious is the third seed, and that's Clemson. I think it'll probably be Ohio State at two and LSU at one. Who's four is going to be really interesting. Is it going to be Alabama? It's going to frustrate everybody. It's going to be Georgia, and that'll frustrate. Whoever is the whomever is picked fourth will be criticized and criticized heavily. They're not that good. They haven't beaten anybody. They lost to so-and-so. I can't believe it. It's SEC bias. It's Pac-12 bias. It is going to be all over the place. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's going to absolutely work its way out because there's controversy very often at the end, but I do think you do need to understand that what it looks like tonight does not mean what it's going to look like at season's end. Too much football left. That's going to shape the fortunes of it, and everybody is going to have their viewpoint of who's the best. I can tell you, I don't care who they rank there. I want them to get it right. I can't tell you what's right at number four. I honestly can't. There is not a fourth team. I grade before I rank. There is not a decisive difference between an Alabama, a Georgia, an Oregon, a Minnesota, a Utah, Oklahoma, a Baylor, although I'd put Oklahoma and Baylor at the bottom of that group. There are flawed teams in all of them. You can look at resume and say, I like this versus that. I like a couple of nice wins more than I like unbeaten against a weaker schedule and a good loss. Everybody has their own little recipe, and it's a conglomeration of a lot of cooks in the kitchen that sometimes make the meal taste a little bit awkward, unpalatable. Folks, I got news for you. I'm not trying to please any of you. I may piss off all of you. I don't think there's a fourth team right now. I think one could emerge. One could separate. But I think that with the biggest games at the end of the year, that's going to be determined. You know my philosophy and theory on it. Always has been play schedules that would be coordinated better, not years in advance. Play a non-Power 5 team week one as kind of a preseason in college. Then play a pre-conference schedule where you play three or four teams from other conferences in the Power 5. Then play your conference schedule. Then have your conference championship game. Then have bowl games in December and make December for college football, which March is for college basketball, and then pick four after that. You can solve some of these arguments, maybe not all of them, but you can solve a lot of them with, let's play it on the field. Make the path of having to earn it that way. Then pick four. And I'm not saying make the bowl games the playoffs. I'm saying make the bowl games an extension of the regular season and pick it. You've heard me say this a bunch if you're a regular listener to this podcast. So I won't belabor that point. But we don't have that, and it doesn't solve all problems. I'm not saying it does. I'm not saying, man, I got all the answers. I don't. It's what I would like to see, because I think that it makes the best regular season in sports. It extends it into December and then leads up to the crescendo of January 1st, and then pick four teams after that. It's what I would like. It's more of what we already love. And it makes the season, which goes by so fast, it goes by so fast because it's going to wrap up in November. It's going to wrap up in a couple of weeks after Thanksgiving weekend. Well, we're going to have the weekend after that. It's conference championship games. Then we wrap it up. Then we have bowl games that not many people watch, and boom, there you are. Champion, the playoff bowl games, and that's that. It's very, very awkward how it's set up. But look, how it looks tonight is not how it's going to look at the end of the season. I can promise you that. There will be changes because things are going to happen to change it. I do not like the setup of announcing it every week. It's a publicity, it is a programming decision by ESPN. They're forcing it on everybody because it gives some people some talk to. But it's not good for the fundamental aspect of picking four teams, because what it does, it confuses, it muddies the water, and it confuses fans as to what the philosophy. The best way to do it, just announce it one time when it's all done. I guess you could have speculation of who's the best. You could still have programming and say, here's who we think's the best, but here's who the committee thinks. Well, the committee thinks this week, it starts over next week, there are going to be drastic changes. They set themselves up for criticism. You can't criticize them for having them ranked here or there in week 5, 6, 7, and week whatever. Right now it's 10, 11, 12, 13. You can't criticize them for moving up or down because they won't be moving up or down. Now, people think it's less transparent that way. I don't think this solves any purpose. I think it opens the door for more criticism. That's what I believe. It's only dealing with the publicity and the programming aspects that this is the reason for it. I want to get into some talk a little bit. Piggybacking off of what I've talked about before, is Chad Morris was let go at Arkansas. His second year. Didn't complete his second year. Is that too soon? Willie Taggart let go at Florida State before the end of the second year. Is that too soon? lot of question marks early in the year about Jeremy Purdy is going to survive after second year. Is it too soon? Here's what's most important, and here's the answer to the question of whether it's too soon or not. It is too soon to pull the trigger on a coach if the coach is going on the right path. If the path is correct, then it's too soon. Where I think people miss the boat is that you must properly identify internally whether you're going on the right path or not. If you're on the wrong path, folks, it's never too soon. If you're going on the wrong path, 1 year into the first year, sometimes you go down a wrong path and you figure it out. By the second year, if you hadn't figured out the path, if you're going down the wrong path, you're in trouble. And at that point, what must be done eventually must be done immediately. So once you're going down the wrong path, starting in the second year, third year, fourth year, fifth, I mean, you got a problem. Because you're not going to get correct. It won't matter how much time. Again, path and pace. Wrong path, time is not the variable. If you're on the right path, the pace can be explained. Look, I get it. There's frustration. We're on the right path. I know we're on the right path, and that's what we're going to stay the course. When we're not on the right path, you move on. That's what I tell administrators all the time. Now, the difficulty is, how do you determine what's the right path? Well, are the players buying in? Is recruiting going well? Are you developing players? Are you losing because you don't have enough players and they're too young? Are they getting better? In Tennessee, Jeremy Pruitt seemingly had lost his team. That's what you heard. Nobody's listening. Well, that wasn't true. That was a lot of talk. If the team wasn't buying in, they couldn't have gotten better. They couldn't have bought in to losing to Georgia State, losing to BYU, got worse and worse and worse. Except the message was still being delivered. It was still being taught. It was still being adhered to. And they're buying in. And they've gotten better and better. And so the path was right. And the pace just it quickened up during the middle and the latter part of the season, hasn't it, for Tennessee? Now, does it guarantee that there are not going to be any speed bumps next year? No, it doesn't guarantee that. Is it going to be a quick ascension to challenge it? No, it's not going to necessarily be that. But the path was right. The pace wasn't. Now it's changed. Now, had things derailed? Had they gotten off path? Had the message not been received? All those things, then you could have seen a situation in Tennessee, much like we've seen in Florida State and Arkansas. In Arkansas, it's gone in the wrong direction. You've got a coach that at least in his second year should have some signs that the offense is getting things figured out, that some of the personnel decisions are getting figured out. When you get beaten by a Western Kentucky team that is putting 35 points and a half, where they haven't scored 30 points in a game yet this season and are doing it behind the quarterback that used to be on your roster that you sent packing or that he left because he wasn't going to be the guy. And listen, Ohio State's, you know, Joe Burrow's having success and Justin Fields left Georgia. The whole transfer stuff, we know it. But the difference is Arkansas doesn't have a quarterback. And they've got a quarterback guru and an offensive guru, and there's no guruing going on. And so the path is wrong, directionless, and they're not buying in, apparently, internally is what they were saying. So that leads to, hey, another year, you're on the wrong path, it's not working. Same thing with Willie Taggart. Can't hire coaches or direct coaches and lead coaches correctly. There's a lot of disorganization, directionless, a lot of problems. That needs to be nipped in the bud. Got to get it corrected early in that second season or it's going to derail. Tennessee corrected it, fixed it internally, on the right path. If it had gotten off, got back on it, it's worked. The other two went off the path, couldn't find the path, and they're gone. So keep that in mind. So, but people generically say, oh, they gave this guy time, you see, and it worked, and they didn't get this time. Again, pace or path. And on the outside, you don't know what the pace is. You don't know what the path is. You can identify the pace pretty well, but the path, you can't. You got to know inside. All right, I want to answer some questions here. Matt asks, considering Pat Fitzgerald's impressive tenure, what dynamics have come together so severely to produce such a horrible team in 2019? Well, developmental programs, well-coached programs, have players that go through the system. And if you have gaps, if you have players in leadership positions, in this case, no skill playmakers on offense, you just don't replace players in Northwestern. You have to develop them. And there's been players that haven't come through successfully that can be properly developed. So he hadn't forgot how to do it. He hadn't forgotten how to coach, but you don't have playmakers. And when you have those gaps, you have the gaps in results as well. You also ask, is it right to assume that Pat hasn't forgot how to lead a program? As I said, correct. You're correct. He hasn't. How come the five-star quarterback Hunter Johnson isn't playing well, considering that's his second year in the program? Because he's not a five-star quarterback. He was a five-star quarterback in ranking, but very often those rankings are inaccurate. There's a reason why he wasn't at Clemson, not just because he was great and somebody else was better, but because he didn't have the qualities, the leadership, the intangibles. He wasn't as good. He had physical skills. He doesn't have Trevor Lawrence type of leadership and intangibles. So he doesn't have that. He struggled. He also doesn't have good talent around him. So you can't dump the ball off to a playmaker out of the backfield or a tight end or a short receiver that can make the play after the catch, because they don't have those guys. So you're having to ask a quarterback to force things, so his productivity is going to go down and down and down because of the lack of playmakers around him. And again, he's not as good. So I'm being a little bit harsh in saying I don't think he has the intangibles. Well, he doesn't. I've evaluated him. But I think his productivity would be a lot better if the play around him was better. So he doesn't have that. And he's not a five-star guy. Pardon me. I'm getting choked up. He was ranked a five-star guy. You're correct. He's misevaluated. In contrast to Pat's past performances, is the severity of the Wildcats' 2019 season is it indicative of weaknesses of Pat Fitzgerald's, or is something changing for Pat? Is he losing his motivation? I don't think Pat's losing his motivation. I think what's happened again is, for whatever reason, they've missed in some of their evaluation process or developmental process or some of the players that they have, and they don't have as many playmakers on either side of the ball. Defensively, they can compete. Offensively, they can't. What's the reason for that, you ask? Well, you know, I don't know that there's any definable reason. There have been not a lot of staff changes, but there have been maybe some issues that have contributed to their misevaluations or misdevelopment in those spots, but they don't have them. It's not real difficult to figure out why they haven't been as good. It's something that's correct to what absolutely is. They haven't forgotten how to coach. They haven't forgotten how to develop. They just don't have the players in which they can develop. And it is about recruiting. You know, it's not five stars like people think. It's about finding the right player that can be developed. And if you don't have if you don't have as many of those players you can develop, it manifests itself on the record. Just like, you know, not having enough five-star guys for big-time programs affect how you do it. Well, if you can be five-star in name, but if you're not players that can be developed and get better through the program, you're going to have an issue. Matt also asks, can you explain the specific dynamic that allow Willie Taggart to succeed in the Division I league, AAC, what he's really saying, the group of five in the American Athletic, and then get significantly exposed in the ACC? Well, first of all, relatively speaking, he succeeded. And yes, he did do enough at South Florida to get an Oregon job. So you're correct in one sense. But the difference level is the level of competition. First of all, I don't think he's done as good a job at Florida State. At South Florida, who you're doing it against makes a difference. Now, he didn't win big there. Okay, so it wasn't like, boy, he was just phenomenal. He did a good enough job to get the Oregon job, but it wasn't as good as people might think. The record kind of allayed some of the issues. But the guy did some things at Western Kentucky to move up. So he has had a better track record. The difference is for him is he had a little bit more success, relatively speaking, finding guys on his staff that did good jobs. Willie is not a great football guy, an X's and O guy. So guys like that are more dependent upon their staff carrying the day. You know, it's important that you got to be able to hire the guy. On a different level, that's what Dabo Swinney and now what Ed Orgeron's doing. They're not putting together the offensive and defensive game plans, but they're putting the pieces together to allow certain guys to do it and flourish. Willie fancies himself a little bit as an offensive genius, and he's not. He's not even close. He's not even good. At South Florida, there was enough success to where it kind of facilitated that thought. He had spent 1 year at Oregon, and it was not a good year at Oregon. They were disorganized. They had a lot of problems. Well, at a bigger-time program, you got more distractions. You got more issues. At a smaller-time program, less so. So he was exposed in 1 year at Oregon, but he still was good enough to be able to get the Florida State job and sell himself there. So he goes to Florida State. He's not able to put together a really good staff, and there's a lot of flaws. He himself is not very organized, and his is a hit or miss in terms of staff hires, as I mentioned. It's not as good. So what are you going to do? He's not been well-developed on defense and on offense. He was his own guy for a while, and he's not very good. Then he hires a coach, and he wants to go up-tempo. And listen, Kendall Briles has got a lot of ability, but then they become so up-tempo that their defense is even worse. He doesn't have a good overall view of the game of football that got hidden a little bit at South Florida because it didn't expose itself relative to the competition. And he had a little bit better staff, at least at that level. I'm not saying the staff was more talented than the one he had at Florida State, but relative to who he's going up against on a week-in, week-out basis, it was. So you're going up against in the ACC. It's not a great – it's certainly the weakest, perhaps, of the Power Five. But look at the coaching that he's going up against. He's outcoached every week. The staff that he's going up against is outcoached every week. I mean, everybody he's going up against is – they're better coached than here. So they've got better talent, but they're undercoached. They underperform. They're underdeveloped. They're out-schemed. All those things have been a factor. So the difference is not just the level of competition, but the inconsistency in being able to hire the right type of guys in a position of authority to run the offense and defense, the getting exposed by the lack of organization is going to expose itself more at a higher profile level. Look, somebody who's at a lower level, the issues and the distractions are not as great. At the bigger level, greater distractions. Now, if you were at South Florida and you have a bad year or two, you can get away with it. You might be able to stumble and get the right hire. If Willie would have, if they just would have given him 5 or 6 years, he might have stumbled and he might have figured out putting together the right staff, and it might have gotten better. But it's such a hit and miss. It's such a unlikely scenario to work that you can't run that risk if you're Florida State. It's gotten so bad so fast that he dug himself such a hole that he's got to go out and hire a better staff when he wasn't able to do it to begin with. Now he's going to have to hire a better staff when it's a lame duck coach and you know that you're going into another year where you're not going to win. Again, you're taking an unlikely situation of success and you're putting further and further obstacles in front of it. That's the biggest issue. So hopefully you get a chance there. What weaknesses were concealed at South Florida than exposed at FSU? Well, again, it's the staff. It's the staff. And it's the organization skills, which is part of staff development and hiring. You know, if you're going to be a good head coach, you've got to be able to cultivate and create an environment of learning. And Willie wasn't very good at that. And he didn't hire very well. And he hired a lot of guys that were quick fixes. And listen, a lot of it, it falls on the fact that you you lose a really good coach in Jimbo Fisher, and you hire a bad coach, and you say the administration's done a poor job of evaluating and assessing things themselves, and two, they've let the program slip from a infrastructure standpoint that it is less desirable than it absolutely should be. It's still a desirable job, but that job should be better. It should look like one of the elite programs in the country in terms of facilities, and it does not. Richard asks, what are the exact rules for players getting drafted from the military schools like Navy, Army, and Air Force, meaning what do they have to go through in order for those players to go to the NFL? Not exact rules, Richard. In fact, President Trump has put something in play that is going to allow guys to come in and pursue their pro career and then deal with the military requirements after it. But that has, in the process, in the transition process, it's a little bit individual. And quite frankly, it's not exact. And I know that I've went to and still deal with them on a regular basis. A guy can come in as long as they're allowed to come in. And they're a little bit more lenient in the past. The rules used to be that you have to serve a certain amount of years before you can come into the NFL. That has been loosened. It is adhered to in some instances. In others, it's not. And you say, well, what is the inconsistencies? Well, depends upon the circumstances of service, the branch, what they do, their philosophy, and, again, the likelihood. And I've worked with a number of them on different ideas about where does the players, where do their potential stack up? That has a lot to do with it. There's a belief that those players going forward and, you know, performing their pro career can only help the services. But there's different ways and different beliefs with that. So there is no exact one. It is more case by case. There are rules, but the rules are modified situation to situation, I'm finding. So I can't give you the exact rules. I can tell you what the exact rules always were, but right now it's a little bit more fluid. And I think if things get fully adhered to, it'll be the rule going forward is likely going to be they can come out, they can compete. But it does depend upon what, again, what is their service, what branch, what have they committed to this point, how long have they been into, all those things are factored in. And so, sorry I can't give you the exact one because it doesn't exist, and it's more individual case by case. Richard also has, what are your assessment of Mike Pereira as a referee? You know, he was very good. I mean, from a judgment standpoint, maybe not better than anyone else, but clear about the rules, clarity, good judgment. And I think he does a good job of explaining things now. And he was pretty good supervisor of officials, too. What was your scouting evaluation of Chris Spielman out of Ohio State? Chris was, what you saw of him, both college and pro level, very instinctive, very good run defender, good zone defender, leader, tough guy, really good tackler, thought he was a really good player. Actually coached against Chris Spielman. When I was at LSU, we played them twice in a home-and-home, and very, very good. He also asked about Garen Veras out of Stanford. Not as high on Garris, but had a pretty had a pretty good grade on him. I think about a third-round grade on him, and I thought he played pretty well. Actually did maybe a tick better than I thought he would coming into the league. Hey, so if you've got a question, send it on over to us. We'll address it right here on this podcast or anywhere else you'd like me to. Check out LandryFootball.com. Get the football season discount 50% off to get the film room grades of all the games, all the inside of the coaching search work. That's what we got it for. It's the most in-depth information you're going to get. So take advantage of it today. We appreciate you joining us. Join us again Thursday for another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
This week on Sitting Ringside, presented by Mack Weldon, the incredible journey of John Arezzi right from the horse's mouth. If you're not familiar with John, he disappeared for a long time out of the business, but now he's back, and he's the guy to blame for Vince Russo being in the wrestling business. Other than that, he also created the wrestling convention that now is seen each and every weekend around the world. If you like wrestling history, or if you just like an incredible roller coaster story, I think you're really going to dig this podcast and enjoy the story right here on Sitting Ringside, powered by Mack Weldon.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.